Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. I want to start today's show by asking you a question. And that question is, how do you define adventure? How do you define adventure? Today's guest says this: adventure pushed me to pedal into the homelands of South Africa when everyone around me told me I'd lose my life. It pushed his cultural limits in small Indian villages, challenged him to visit Bosnia while troops and tanks were the norm, and prodded him to spend 3 months in Cuba, even though his government said he couldn't do it. Well, my guest is Willie Weir. He's a writer, photographer, adventurer, and speaker. He's a traveling commentator for public radio and a columnist for Adventure Cyclist magazine. His articles on adventure travel earned him a gold and bronze Lowell Thomas Award from the American Society of Travel Writers. And he's the author of Spoke Songs. His new book is called Travels with Willie, Adventure Cyclist. Willie Weir, welcome to the show.
It's a delight to be here.
Very pleased to have you here. I spent the most delightful afternoon reading through your book, traveling vicariously to all these wonderful places that I still have yet to go. You've traveled all over the world, often into areas that are perceived by others to be dangerous. You've gone up all kinds of terrain, across all kinds of country, weather. Why travel by bicycle? What's the appeal for you?
It is what I call the world's last innocent form of transportation. And I always tell people that I'm not an avid cyclist. I'm an avid traveler who happened to discover the bicycle as a vehicle of travel. And it allows you to get into people's lives and into a culture very quickly and very deeply, like you can't in so many other ways. And part of the reason is that the bicycle is innocent and it's very vulnerable. You are vulnerable on a bicycle. And that can have its negative connotations, but mostly they're positive. And when you yourself are vulnerable in a culture, in a place, people are willing to be vulnerable with you. And to me, that's what travel's about.
Yeah, I thought you made a great point in the book, because you said many travelers they like to travel, but they don't like to be out of their comfort zone. Mm-hmm. And you actually admitted that you're no different to that, but the bicycle forces you to get out of that comfort zone.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not an extraordinary person in that sense of being a super athlete or it's just that the bicycle, for me, at the end of the day, if there's a chance to have a beer and be able to speak my own language with somebody, I will often take that as well. And right now, around the world, there are backpackers lodging everywhere. In fact, you could go right today and go visit Thailand. And every single day you were there, if you were on the train or traveling by bus, you could spend the night in a backpacker's lodge and speak English and find yourself in that sense of being in a country without really being in it. And a bicycle, very often you can't travel the distance, so you end up in those in-between places. And it's in those places that I find that you have those discoveries. They're not always the most comfortable places to be. In fact, they rarely are. But that is when you come back from a journey and realize that's where you learned not only lessons about where you were at, but very often lessons about yourself as well.
Well, we want to hear some of those lessons. Right. But you say come back, and you come back right here to Seattle, right?
I do.
Yeah.
I live on Beacon Hill with my wife, Kat, and my cat's name is Dieter. And we've been there for 12 years. I've lived in Seattle since 1985. But also, as far as traveling, I spent 5 months on the bicycle every year for 7 years. And those were trips in Mexico and Central America and New Zealand and India and in South Africa and Bosnia. And then when I met Kat, she ended up coming along with me. And in fact, when we did meet, I had already decided to go on this trip in the Balkans. In fact, everything was already set up. I'd come back from South Africa. I was already writing for the World Wide Web when people were calling it the World Wide What. They didn't know what it was. So writing the Global Network Navigator. I had no idea. In fact, I remember just in awe of being someplace and actually being able to email in a commentary. I mean, that was just, that was magic. And so this is back in 1995, 1996. And we met, very quickly fell in love, only to realize that in 3 months I was leaving for another 5 months. And so for the first time in my life, I was leaving on an adventure that I didn't want to be on. I thought, you know, I'm going to leave and I'm going to come back and Kat's going to have left. That's going to be it. And I was heading over to Bosnia and Croatia. Wasn't sure where I was going to be able to go. I was going as a solo traveler. Wasn't going with journalists, any kind of journalist credentials. And when I got over there, and actually from Ljubljana, the capital of Slovenia, I ended up getting a call from Kat. And she'd gotten my phone number from the radio station. And she said, you know, I'd really love to be on this adventure with you. And I said, are you serious? And she said, yes. I said, well, okay. And she ended up then joining me after I'd gone through Bosnia and Croatia, was back in Hungary. And the first time that she bicycled with panniers on a bicycle was from the airport in Budapest into downtown Budapest. And then we took off from there. And yes, it had definitely its ups and downs and its trials. But I think what's a great example of that is that because I've done it, I had done it so much that people say, well, I could never do that. And you're so experienced. And I said, look, here's somebody who just made the decision. I want to have an adventure. And there she was off on one. And I think that the great thing about if you look within the pages of that book is that it really could be travels with anybody. Because the great thing about a bicycle is that you can do it at any age. And you can do it on a budget that almost everybody can afford. And you truly can have an adventure. And you can also have that adventure right within your own city.
Mm. And I'm not giving away tales here because you say this in the book that you're 46-ish now.
I'll be 48 in August.
Okay, well, so, close enough, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, people really can do it at any age. Mm-hmm. It's just the determination to do it, right?
Oh, definitely. I was speaking at a bookstore in Yakima years ago. And small audience, and this woman walked in. I could tell she was probably in her, gosh, late 70s, maybe early 80s. And she was, you know, going to go look at a book, but she saw that I was speaking, and she stood in the back of the room, and she had this big smile on her face. And it was a knowing smile. And I finished up, and I walked over to her, and I said, you've done this, haven't you? And she said, yes, I have. Do you know that I have bicycled across the United States 5 times.
Wow.
And I said, really? And I said, it must be amazing because how you've seen the country change over the years. I mean, did you do your first trip when you were in high school and then college and then later on? And she said, the first time I ever bicycled across the United States was when I was 67 years old.
Oh, my goodness me.
So you'll find that. You find inspiration on the road. And and it's just delightful.
Yeah. I have an aunt, actually, who travels. I think she's about 80 now, and she's just gone over on one of those ships where they take the, it's a cargo ship. That's what I'm looking for.
Wow.
Yeah, she does the cargo ship thing because she does not fly. And then she just kind of travels around and stays with various people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you actually proposed to Kat on one of the trips. Tell us that story because that brought a lump to my throat.
Okay. Well, Kat, when she arrived and when we had a tearful goodbye in Seattle, when she arrived in Budapest on that bicycle, I had decided that I was going to ask her to marry me.
And you'd only known one another how long?
For about 4 months.
You just knew.
Yeah, I did. You know, I think there's that you get to a certain age, and I think you make those decisions a lot quicker than you did when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
And often I find myself when I'd meet somebody and realize I'd gone through the entire relationship and that wasn't going to work out in 45 seconds at a party. Where when you're in your teens, it takes months and years to figure those things out. So when Kat arrived in Budapest, we ended up going down and Buda, and it's two cities, Buda and Pest, and the beautiful bridges across the river. And I ended up walking down there and basically saying, and you know, giving her a tour. And I said, and this is the bench where I decided I wanted to ask you to marry me. And I ended up, you know, most people, of course, would have the ring, and I didn't. And I was a frugal traveler, and I handed her a coin. And it was a lira coin from Italy. And what it was when I had decided that that to ask her, when she'd called me, said, can I come and join you? And I'd said, well, you should really think about this. And the moment I hung up the phone, I thought to myself, oh, my God, you just made the worst decision in your life because she is going to think it over and think, no, there's no way I'm going to do this. And so I was cycling in Slovenia and what happened is that it was a lot cheaper to call from Italy than it was from Slovenia. So I crossed over the border, and in order to make the payphone work, I had to use the lira coin, and I put it in, and she didn't answer. And I got her answering machine, and I basically said, I'm so sorry. I told you to think about this. I realized that, you know, I really do want you to be here. And please, if you've thought no, don't think no anymore. And of course, I rambled on for way too long. And there was a moment that you want to wish you could erase the message, but it's just out there. And I hung up the phone and went, oh, boy. Oh, well, I guess that's over. And a couple of days later, and of course, when I ended up activating the phone because I used a calling card, that little coin came back. And I ended up using that coin when I called her 3 days later, and she did. She said yes. And so when I asked her to marry me, I gave her that coin. And as you've read in the book later on, and this was a journey, and I'm sure that for the two of us, there will ever be an adventure with the ups and downs that this had, because it was part of the beginning of a relationship, but it was cycling through Romania and Bulgaria, Macedonia and Albania, and we had, you know, sickness and dealing with just the health issues and also just the physical issues. It's just very, the Balkans, I mean, it means mountains.
Right.
So there was very few flat days, but we ended up, after having literally, I would say, probably a dozen different times when between the two of us that we thought that this was really the wrong idea. But we'd managed to stick it through, and we had bicycled into Albania, and which again was another country we didn't know we were going to be able to even cross the border then. It had just opened up after 60 years. Enver Hoxha, who had basically ruled that country with an iron fist, and we were on a road, and we were robbed, and robbed and beaten on a lonely highway. And there was that moment where we sat kind of, you know, bloody and bruised in the road and just thankful that we were alive. But there was a moment where, and they'd taken cameras and whatnot, but not the bicycles. And Kat had kept that coin in her little pouch of the passport. And she looked up at me and, you know, we realized what, and she said, "The coin, they got the coin." And there was that moment, you know, and you just look at each other and go, well, we're alive, it's okay. And this village woman who they'd come up from the side and saw what had happened, there were several women and they were going around. And this woman walked up and handed Kat this bag, and they'd obviously ripped the passport out of it, but inside was that coin, and she still wears that around her neck.
Oh, see, that really, that brought a lump to my throat. I was reading that. That was meant to be, yeah. Right?
And I call it the world's cheapest engagement ring, but at the same time, it means so much more than a diamond ever would.
Well, you're talking about all these places that many tourists never get to. You really do get off the tourist trap there. Mm-hmm. How do you cope with the language barrier? I read that you said the language barrier is only as tall and wide as you make it.
Oh, that is so true. And most people, again, assume, number one, that I'm an athlete. Number two, that I speak several languages and I have this gift for idiom. Not at all. I came very close to flunking high school Spanish. I took it only because it was a requirement to go on to college, and really did not like it at all. And for me, what as you asked before, you know, what is an adventure? For me to be able to have an adventure, you have to face a fear, and that is a physical fear, an emotional fear, a religious fear, any fears. It's getting over those. Well, I had to finally admit to myself, because I realized I had planned trips to, you know, the United States and Canada, New Zealand and Scotland and New Zealand, you know, they were all English-speaking countries. And, well, they were just places I was interested in. That was it. That was, no, really. You're afraid to travel someplace where you don't speak the language. No, you're not afraid. You're horrified of it to the point where you even go. Well, I was on my way to bicycle across the southern United States. And the great thing about traveling alone is you can change your mind. And while I was on Amtrak, I did. I changed my mind. I got off, and instead of headed east, I went south and crossed the border into Mexico. And as with my heart pounding, and within 48 hours, oh my God, the rest of the world opened up. Because even with my poor high school C-minus Spanish, people's eyes lit up when I just tried to use it. And I realized that this fear, and that's the thing about fears, they're intangible, and they will keep you just absolutely in your seat or in your home. You'll never get out there. I always tell people that in the sense that fear keeps you away, and that's the way, you know, and you caution keeps you aware, and fear keeps you away. And yeah, you need to be cautious, and I have been to some very dangerous places, but caution is what tells you where you can go in those places. Fear is what keeps you home, because you heard something on cable news or whatever, and you think, oh, I can't go to Eastern Europe. Oh, I can't go to the Balkans, or I can't. When Kat and I traveled in Turkey, it just so happened that the day that we arrived, the U.S. troops went into Baghdad, And that was a very unpopular time to be an American in that part of the world. And it'd be very easy to just say no, but it was 4,000 miles away from the conflict. But I can't tell you how many people told us, don't think about going. It's dangerous. Mm-hmm. It's horrible.
But you say in the book mm-hmm. two things. Number one, you never deny being an American, because a lot of travelers will say, oh, I'm Canadian. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't even say I'm British now because we're right there by the Americans. So, but a lot of people will say I'm Canadian because it's perceived to be more neutral. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is that it just flew right out of my head. What's the other thing you say?
Well, I always say that if somebody comes to you and gives you the, you know, oh, don't go there, the first thing you have to ask is, have you been there? And if that answer is no, then you can just say, you know, I don't really want to hear it. That's fine. If you've been there and you want to give me some information, and even if it's horrible information, that's fine. But if you're telling me something that you heard from your brother who was at the auto parts store who was listening to something on television, It's very often you'll find that if you use that filter, the fear filter, I call it, you'll find out that most of the time for instance, Turkey. To this day, I haven't found anybody who's traveled in Turkey who's ever said anything negative about their experience there.
You know, I have not either. Mm-hmm. I've met a lot of people who've gone to Turkey mm-hmm. and returned many, many, many times.
Yep.
And they say the people are very, very hospitable.
Including my dear friend Rick Steves, who adores Turkey. It's a traveler's dream. I mean, and albeit not everybody's going to want to travel there by bicycle, but however you travel there, it is one of those places where East meets West, and it's as hospitable. I mean, literally, Kat and I, if we had accepted every invitation for tea in 3 months, we wouldn't have got now 20 kilometers outside of Istanbul. I mean, we were invited in. I mean, at one point, I counted. I'd had 14 cups of tea by the time we hit 1 p.m. in the afternoon. And there is no decaf in Turkey. But it was just amazing. And here was this place where, I had my postal worker, delivery person knock on my door and say, you're going to Turkey? Oh, I hear they hate all Christians there. And, of course, this is at the time when the war was just... And you just have to put those fears aside.
Yeah.
And part of that is, and this has only come from, you know, so many years of traveling and having that and realizing when you get there that the experience is so very different than the perception that you'll get from, you know, from the media, no matter how you look at it, because the media is always focusing on the negative things. That's what
sells. And you would have missed some incredibly wonderful experiences. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest is Willie Weir. Stay with us.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Japanese researcher Masaru Emoto explored the vibration of music on water. Since our bodies are largely water, does it follow that music can heal our bodies? Patricia Hurlby says yes. Please join us next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for Music Consciousness, the Power to Heal. See conversationslive.net for guests and show details.
Spread the word. Your favorite shows are on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
I've got a bike, you can ride it if you like. It's got a basket, a bell, and rims and things to make it look good.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And my special guest today is Willie Weir. He's a writer, photographer, adventurer, speaker, and cyclist. His new book is called Travels with Willie. This is a great read. Travels with Willie, Adventure Cyclist. And as I said at the top of the hour, I had a very nice afternoon living vicariously through Willie's travels because I can't go anywhere right now. So I wanted to talk about a couple of things, a couple of philosophies you have.
Okay.
You say that You went riding once with a friend named Randy,
mm-hmm.
and he was embarrassed by what he called your mooching.
Mm-hmm.
You said, no, we're just simply initiating kindness.
Right.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, Randy at one point, because I've known Randy since I was in high school. And of course, and our other good buddy, Thomas, was the gentleman who I bicycled across the United States with back in 1981. That was my first big bike trip. And we ended up being invited into people's homes everywhere. It was amazing, especially in the Midwest. I mean, there'd be times when I was up in Canada, I ended up having a 2-week period where I realized I hadn't spent any money because everybody kept inviting me in and then
right.
sending me to a relative's house and packing. You know, they pack you a lunch, which would be food for 4 days. I mean, for a cyclist, it was incredible. And you regale your friends with these stories. And Randy said, you know, Willie, you know what you are? And I thought he was going to say, oh, you're a regal traveler and trip and traveler. And he goes, you're the world's biggest mooch. And it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around that. When I thought, oh, I don't necessarily like that term. And so I said, you know, no, I'm not. I'm an initiator of kindness. And fortunately, Randy ended up on a trip with me in New Zealand, and we had the chance to see that happen as well. But that idea, at least how I've come to it as a traveler, is—and this is something that's unique about the bicycle being, as I said, the last innocent form of transportation. We so rarely have the opportunity in our workaday world and the world as we live in it now to really— get to be kind, because we're told so often that, you know, don't answer your door if you don't know who's behind it. If
mm-hmm.
you see somebody who has had trouble on the side of the road, call 911. Don't even think. So very often we are literally physically removed from acts of kindness. You end up writing out a check at the end of the year or whatever. But when do you actually get to be kind? Well, enter the touring cyclist, and who basically needs a place to set up a tent somewhere and maybe some water or whatever. And again, the bicycle itself, it's very exposed. It's hard to hide things on it or whatever. And so people are, you know, very often will show you a place to set up your tent. But very often that leads to end up having the guest bedroom in the house as well. And I really thought, well, it seems to just be a one-way street. And people just keep giving you things. And it really wasn't until an experience I had in upstate New York that I really understood that it ended up being something that was give and take. Because there was a cycling in upstate New York, and there was this huge thundercloud that was coming towards me that I wasn't very concerned about, because I'm from the West Coast, and when it rains, it just kind of, you know, drizzles a bit. And
right,
I didn't realize
right.
that when it rains there, that 7 million gallons of water could dump out of the sky and they blow you off the side of the road. So the sky opened up, and I looked across the highway, and there was a large house there with a porch, and I drug my bicycle up onto it, and so out from under the rain, and all of a sudden a door opened up, and this head, you know, poked out and was looking at me, and I looked at it and said, "Sir, I'm so sorry. I'm just under your porch. Obviously, the rain is coming in, and I will leave as soon as the storm has passed, if that's okay with you." And he looked at me, and his head, you know, poked out a little further. He goes, "Oh no, come on in. We're watching Superman." And ended up being this father with his two little kids.
Right.
They were 4 and 6 years old, and they sat me down and on the couch, and he said, "You know, you want me to fill you in on the plot?" I said, "No, I've seen Superman. Know what it is?" So we sat down and finished Superman, and of course, then the kids asked questions of the bike with all its gear and stuff. And he says, "Look, I have to go to bed early, and I'm putting the kids to bed. My wife works, and she gets home late. I'll leave a note for her, and you have the couch." Well, this guy leaves a note. And so the note on the door said, "Guy on couch, okay. See bicycle in kitchen." And so at 2 o'clock in the morning, there was the door. I opened up the door, and the door was open, and this woman came sneaking in because she didn't want to wake up the guest who was on the, which was me. And I said, "No, I'm actually awake. Don't worry about that." And she turned on the light, and she looked at the bicycle in with all the gear on it. She said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, actually, I bicycled across Canada, and now I'm headed to a family reunion." She goes, "On that bicycle?" And I said, "Yes." So she sat down at the edge of the sofa and for the next 2 hours just grilled me on everything that happened uh-huh. on the journey and all the thing. And finally she looked at her watch. She says, "Oh, I have to get to bed because I have to get up and make breakfast." So fine. A few hours later, I smell bacon and eggs. And she walks in the room and she hands me this plate. She said, "I want to thank you so much." And I looked at her and I said, "I've been just sleeping on your couch. I got to watch
right,
videos
right.
and you're feeding me breakfast and I'm, no, I'm supposed to thank you." And she goes, "No, you don't understand something." She says, "You know, I work at a job I've worked at this job for a long time, and it's a job I don't like very much at all. And you know what? For the first time in a very, very long time, I'm going to work this morning, and I have something to talk about. Thank you. And that was the moment that I really, truly understood that there is the initiating kindness, but there is this give and take that's there as a traveler. But it also reminded me this, as many times people, I always ask the same three or four questions. Where have you been? Where are you going? Whatever. And after a while, you get tired of answering. But you know what? As a job, my job as a traveler is to always answer those questions, because people love to vicariously be involved, because there's so many people in this world that don't get a chance.
Right, you know, right.
Travel is not a right. It is a privilege. And many people here in the United States never take advantage of that privilege. And believe me, that's another part of the book.
Well, let's talk about that, because, you know, some listeners might be thinking, well, that's great, but, you know, I have to go to work. And,
I,
how does he do all this? Mm-hmm. Well, you do talk about that in the book.
Yeah.
You made some very definite lifestyle choices. You don't have a car.
Right.
You said, I love this, because you went house hunting.
Uh-huh.
And you were very fearful, but you knew that you'd married the right woman when Kat told the realtor, we want something small and ugly.
Right, exactly. Well, I was looking at a 30-year mortgage, which for an adventure traveler was just a death sentence. I thought, that's it. It's over. You know,
right.
Everybody I ever knew. And I try to tell people as young as possible, high school, when I speak at high schools and universities or whatever, the most important decision that we ever made, travel decision, was buying half the house the bank said we could buy instead of 125%. And we aren't taught that in school. We aren't taught that.
Right.
And it is a decision that affects not only what you can do with the rest of your life, what you can be, and that opened up that opportunity. And because we don't have a mortgage that weighs us down to the point where we have to work 80 hours a week, you know, 52 weeks out of the year. And the other thing, that the gift that I was given, that I think I mentioned in the acknowledgments, was from my mother. And it was funny, she doesn't even remember telling me this. I said, Mom, you know what the most important thing you ever said to me? She goes, no, I don't. I said, I'd just come back from my first bicycle trip, and I'd taken a quarter off of college, and I didn't know what I was going to do. That confused point of life.
Yeah.
And you looked at me, and you sat down the bed and said, you know what? I want you to know something. Whether you decide to be a doctor, whether you decide to be a professor, whether you decide to be a biologist, whether you decide to put a backpack on your back and travel the world for the rest of your life, I want you to know something. I consider you a success.
And that is such a gift.
You know, you owe your kids roots and wings, and those were my wings. It was no matter what I do, I'm a success already. And thanks, Mom. I mean, that allowed me to do so many of the things that without that permission, I never would have attempted.
Yeah, and you're right, because many of us have that pressure from, you buy your first home and then people are like, well, when are you going to buy a bigger house?
Mm-hmm.
And when are you going to buy a flashier car?
Right.
And people, we do tend to buy into that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's absolutely no reason. You live very well, I'm sure, and you know, get to see all the world and have all these fabulous stories to share.
Well, I think that Americans are really, really good at living busy lives. We aren't very good at living full lives.
Mm.
And I think part of that is that busyness is at a certain point just becomes chaotic. And there's that moment. And the great thing that I find, because I can run into that trap as well at home. On a bicycle, it's a very simplified life. You're getting from point A to point B. Hopefully, you're enjoying a lot of stuff in between that point A and point B. But you're looking for some place to pitch a tent and some food. And life gets very simple. Of course, now with Blackberries and whatever, people can, you know, and I've met people on the road who've managed to keep their busyness in this travel around the world, because now, there's another piece in the book about when is staying in touch too much. And I think now with the technology, it's, I call the World Wide Web or the Internet the world's longest umbilical cord. I mean, you can go and go, but still be attached 4,000 miles away or 10,000 miles away. And
you choose not to do that, right? You don't take a laptop anyway.
No, I haven't taken a laptop, and that might change. But at the same time, I mean, I remember when I bicycled across the U.S. in 1981, there were 4 phone calls home and I think 3 mail stops along the way. And part of that was we couldn't afford. I mean, phone calls were expensive, but it really was a journey not only, and it is a very poetic journey to be able to, with your own power, get across your country. But at the same time, it's that moment of being alone and being separate. I mean, I have my buddy Thomas with me, but you leave friends and family behind, and yes, you miss them. And there was, I think, it ended up being a much better experience because of that separation, as opposed to the hourly phone call on the cell phone at home, just checking in, okay, I'm okay.
Right.
Which I think happens now all the time.
Let's talk about being a writer, because okay. You say that you don't, you said in the book you actually don't like writing, but you found a way that works for you. And I want to know, did you find this kind of work because you wanted to travel, or how did it all come together for you?
Well, again, with having a mother who says you're a success no matter what, allows you to think, okay, I had worked in the theater for about 7-8 years, and had really enjoyed it. But at a certain point, I realized that I sat down and decided to write down my dreams. I think everybody should, every year or so, take down a piece of paper and say, what are my dreams? Mm-hmm. Those aren't something that you should leave behind when you're a kid, as an adult, and they do change. I remember looking at that, and I was working in Madison at the Madison Repertory Theater, doing a show there, and I put down a piece of paper, and it was blank after 20 minutes of putting theater down. And I realized, you know what? It's time to change, but I didn't know what it was. And so I ended up getting a job with a bicycle touring company, because I'd bicycle across the country. I thought, well, it's one job where in an interview, being a slacker and bicycling across the country was going to end up being to my advantage. But it allowed me to then, you know, continue on. So what it really came down to was I followed the travel bug. And I ended up, because on public radio, you end up as an actor on radio talking about the show you were in. And I ended up doing an interview based on the journal that I wrote to my brother. And what had happened when I tried to cycle before, and that is, it's hard. It's much easier to do train travel and write, because it goes by and you have lots of hours.
Yeah, it's kind of hard when you have to watch.
Yeah, exactly.
And watch you're cycling.
On a bicycle trip, you're in after an 80-100 mile day, and you sit down your tent and you think, okay, I've got to recap the day's events, and 30 seconds later, you're asleep. And I found that my journals just ended up being little scribbles of notes that I couldn't decipher. And then I realized that I had my brother, Jeff, who I just love dearly. He's 7 years older than me and not a traveler. But
he doesn't even have a passport.
He doesn't have a passport. He doesn't. But I decided to write my journal in letters to him. And that changed everything, because, number one, it became an obligation I wanted to do. And also it made me be much more descriptive, because I wasn't writing notes to myself. And for everything I left out, my brother didn't get to come along. And so that became a way for me to be able to get my words down. And, you know, I failed English 1A in college, and I ended up majoring in theater just to avoid having to write term papers. But the one thing I did know from theater was to be able to tell a story. I mean, a monologue is trying to get somebody's attention right away. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up writing, while I was in India, writing a 3-minute piece every week and sending off in a 3-rupee aerogram back to the local public radio station, KUOW, in Seattle. And they ended up, I thought that if I was lucky, they'd read one of them. And I found out halfway through the journey that they were going to read the entire series.
Oh, that's great.
And that's the moment that writer's block began. Oh, my God. Because I didn't think anybody was going to hear it.
The pressure's on.
Oh, my God. It was just horrible. And I still have to chain myself to my computer to write a column. I'd rather be on stage. I'd rather be talking to people than having to put my thoughts
Well,
on
you're
it.
So good at it. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Liftoff. You mm-hmm. have a chapter called Liftoff in mm-hmm. the book, because, or a column in there. We should say this book actually is a series of your columns, right?
I write for a members publication called Adventure Cyclist, and it's the magazine of the Adventure Cycling Association, which used to be known as Bike Centennial years ago. It's a nonprofit based out of Missoula, Montana, that sole purpose is to be able to inspire people of all ages to travel by bicycle. And that's exactly what they do. And they have like now 35,000 miles worth of bicycle routes that are mapped out around the United States. But I write for their magazine, Adventure Cyclist. And for me, Liftoff is what I've discovered. And another thing I try to tell high school and college students is to get out and travel as soon as you can. A lot of people say, I'm going to wait till I get established. No. Travel is never easier than when you're young, because you don't have the trappings of life. I mean, I mentioned in that piece that, you know, for me, leaving was more like, you know, being a hummingbird and just you know, you watch a hummingbird just light on a branch and then in an instant they're gone. And when I was an actor and I lived in a dumpy apartment in Seattle where you could see your breath from, you know, October 15th to March 15th, because we couldn't pay for heat, And it was a delight to leave. I was so excited. and all my possessions actually fit not in a friend's house, but in a friend's closet. And so being able to plan and leave on an adventure was incredibly easy. And now, you know, decades later, I live in a beautiful little home. I mean, it originally was a small and ugly house, but we've turned it into quite a paradise with a garden and a little cat that I adore and involved in the neighborhood. So for us to leave off, and I use the image of watching, you know, the shuttle, the space shuttle take off, and you watch all of that energy, and actually over 90% of the energy that the space shuttle uses an entire journey is actually just getting out of the gravity of the Earth's pull. And that's what it feels like now, because, of course, there's the thousand things you have to do and make sure bills get paid and whatever.
And your cat is taken care of.
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? As much as I didn't want to admit it, you know, and I just thought I'm going to be one of those people who can always, you know, camp and tent and whatever. I have to admit that, yes, my body is a lot more sore sleeping in a tent than it was 20 years ago. And thank goodness for those Therm-a-Rest, you know, pads or whatever mine get a little bit thicker and thicker as I travel. And so it is much more difficult to go. But once I get there, we both know it's always worth the effort.
Mm. Well, I'm a camper too. And I know that those first couple of nights are really painful.
Oh, my goodness. Well, and those first couple of days on a bicycle seat, if you're on a journey,
yes,
can even, yeah.
Yeah.
When Kat joined me that first day, and again, she hadn't done any long distance traveling, and we'd done a 60, 70 mile day in Hungary outside of Budapest. And I watched her get on that seat the very first morning. And I watched her eyes just literally bug out as she sat down and then got off. And I said, "Can you describe it?" And she said, "If it hurt any worse, I'd throw up."
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it does take a while. Yep.
Any idea how many thousands of miles you've cycled?
You know, I don't carry an odometer anymore. Kat has one on her bicycle. But I would say somewhere between 60 and 80,000 miles as far as travel miles. But then that doesn't add that. I was a bicycle courier at one point, and then I, you know, commuted to. And we've been without a car for the last 4 years, so there's more bicycling there. But miles, and I think this is also a transition that happens as a traveler. At least for me, I'll make it personal. For me, I've noticed that those miles were so important to begin with. In fact, when I was a kid, I had one of those odometers when they first came out that had the little thing that ticked along, and there was another one that had a little belt that you put on, and it would show you your mileage on your bike. And I remember at one point looking down when I was 13 years old, and I'd been on this bike trip. For me, a bike trip was like 12 miles then. Yeah. And I got back home, and I realized the belt had fallen off. And so I literally went in the garage, and I put the belt back on, and with my hand, I spun the bicycle tire to put those 12 miles, because I had earned them.
Oh, my God.
They were so important. Until my hand was bloody, you know? I was like, I'm not going to... And my first bicycle trip across the United States, my buddy Thomas, I knew my daily mileage, my average daily mileage, every single little bit, and now I couldn't tell you.
It's the experiences now that matters.
Yeah, exactly. Miles to memories. And the memories become so... Because after you've climbed 200 mountain passes, the fact of how long they were and how high they were don't make as much of an impression as who you end up meeting on the top of that mountain pass.
Mm. You do talk about the steepest street in the world.
Which, of course, is in San Francisco,
Baldwin
right?
Baldwin Street.
Yep. in Dunedin, on the south island of New Zealand, there's a beautiful town called Dunedin, which, of course, I believe Mark Twain said that Dunedin is where the Scots stopped thinking they'd arrived in heaven, you know, on their way to heaven. They landed in Dunedin. And I was at a pub in Dunedin, and this man looked at my bicycle shorts and said, tell me you're a bicycle traveler. You know, yeah. He goes, do you happen to know where the steepest street in the world was? And I know it's a leading question.
Mm-hmm.
I said, San Francisco? He goes, nope, right here in Dunedin. You know, and he says, if you really want, you take all that stuff off your bicycle and see if you can climb it. Well, that was a challenge I wanted to take. Now, to give an example, I mean, the steepest street that I know of, or is close to our house, is about 22% grade. And Baldwin Street in Dunedin, tops out at 42.5% grade. It is in the Guinness book. I looked it up later. But I went back and took everything. And of course, when you're traveling, you've got all this stuff on your bicycle. I took all off. And I felt as light as a bird, and I bicycled towards Dunedin Street, and I turned the corner, and I looked up at that, and I'm from California originally. I had never seen anything steeper in my life, and the blood just drained out of my legs, and every muscle, every fiber, every brain cell said, there's no way you can do this, but you're here, you might as well try. So I figured I'm going to cycle until I fall over backwards or just, have to hop off the bicycle, and I started pedaling, and it starts off at about 15-20% grade, and then it really hits that steep grade. And I literally felt the tire start to pull off, and I was at that moment where I thought, okay, this is it. And all of a sudden, I started to hear this clapping and this cheering. And I looked over, and here was this group, this family of Japanese tourists that were on the sidewalk because nobody drives up the street. You're not allowed to drive up it. There's a big sign that says you should not drive up.
You should be tipping backwards on yourself.
Oh, exactly. And they started cheering. And all of a sudden, I was in the Tour de France. I mean, heading for it. And I just gave it all I could. And I actually managed to get to the top. And I love going downhill. And I love going downhill fast. But I will be perfectly honest with you and tell you that I turned my bicycle around and I looked down and I got off and I walked down. That is how steep it was.
But did you stick a Willy Weir summited flag at the top?
No, I didn't. But it becomes that mental thing that you use. And I always say, I can't tell you how many times in my life I've always said, it's not as bad as Baldwin Street. Bad as Baldwin Street.
Well, we're going to continue our conversation with Willy Weir. He's got some great tales. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk podcast reviews brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk podcasts today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Commune with the Pop Oracle on the Radio 8 Ball Show. I'm Andras Jones, the host of the Radio 8 Ball Show, where we answer your questions by picking songs at random and interpreting them as the answers, like picking musical tarot cards. That's the Radio 8 Ball Show on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Don't miss the Radio 8 Ball Show now at its new time, Wednesdays at noon, here on Alternative Talk, 1150.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick and Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Good news, Belgium. We're streamed worldwide at 1150kknw.com. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Welcome back. We are talking today with adventure cyclist Willie Weir. He lives right here in Seattle, but has traveled all over the world. He said earlier, probably 60 to 80,000 miles of cycling travel he's done. And his new book is called Travels with Willie, Adventure Cyclist. A great read if you want to spend an afternoon living vicariously with Travels with Willie. I want to ask you, there was a story in the book called The Father's Touch, and I thought this was a lovely story. It was really touching. And you said you learned a lot about your father from the way that this man touched you. I wonder if you'd share that story with us.
Yeah, I've learned so many lessons on the road, and it's often how my own personal relationships have been affected by things that have happened to me 5,000 miles away from the people that I love. Kat and I were traveling in Thailand. And we were doing what I call the gamble, and that is you're cycling along, and you look at the map, and you realize that there isn't a town anywhere near, and there's going to be no place to stay, but you just head on out, and you figure it when the sun starts to set, you're going to find a place, and that's the great thing about traveling with a tent. And we ended up coming into beautiful. It's a northern Thailand. You know, most of the forests have been cut down, the teak forests, but there's lots of second growth. And there was this little tamarind tree grove. And we went by and we saw this younger couple who kind of smiled at us as we bicycled by. And we both thought, okay, we should go, you know, ask them. And of course, neither Kat and I speak Thai. So a lot of it ends up being sign language, but it's amazing how much you can communicate. We basically, you know, showed that was there a place for us to camp? And they pointed over. And we found out that there was an old man who lived over on that property, and he would probably let us stay there, but they would go and talk with him. So they ended up knocking on the door, and this man came out. He was blind in one eye, and married, and his wife ended up coming out. But he showed an area in the tamarind tree orchard that we could set up our tent. And we really thought that that might be the last time that we saw them, because the sun was setting, some mosquitoes were coming out, And so we got inside the tent, and they went inside their little humble dwelling. But they came out afterwards and ended up inviting us in to bathe, which basically was a bucket over in the corner with some fresh water. But then sat outside, and there was a little fire going. And this man sat down next to the fire, and I sat down next to him, and Kat sat next to his wife. And this man proceeded to look at me and then grab my forearm. And he kind of massaged it a bit, and then my shoulder as well. And he got very close to me. I could smell his breath. And what was so bizarre is the moment he touched my forearm, I was 12, 13, 14 years old. Because that's the way my dad, when I would come home after being somewhere, or even when I came back from, you know, from college and went visit, well, the first thing my dad would do, he'd shake my hand, but then he'd feel my forearm. It was like somebody, you know, feeling a prized race horse or something. Uh-huh. And I remember as a young kid, you know, you're at that age where just
parents don't touch me.
Oh, good. You know, you don't want to have anything to do with parents in any manner. It's like, Dad, what are you doing? That's just weird. And there's this moment, this man just looked into my eyes and he grabbed my shoulder, and I was looking into the eyes of my dad. And there was this moment of understanding of what my father was doing, and that truly, in its purest and simplest form, my father was just being in touch. And we found out later that evening from there was a woman who dropped by who did speak some English, and she was able to translate that this younger couple didn't have any children. They weren't able to have any children, and they were probably in their late 70s. And we ended up, you know, just laughing around. And of course, you know, you talk about the language barrier. You just get out there, and what you find is very often I find that some of the best communication happens when you don't speak any language. Because when you speak a little bit of language, you end up doing stuff like, what do you do for a living? Or, you know, what is silly, stupid, you know, but yeah, when you don't speak a language, you end up communicating in emotions, in feelings, and, you know, whatever, in pantomime or whatever. And we ended up, the woman was singing these songs and then had me sing a show tune, and oh, the cackling of laughter around. And it was just absolutely delightful. And it just, remember getting back in the tent and just realizing that here in that simple moment, how much I'd learned about my own father, but at the same time realizing that in that same touch that man had maybe had a chance to feel like what it had to have had a son. And there's those simple moments that on the road, and maybe it is the bicycle, and that maybe they happen to us all the time, but when our busy lives are surrounded, those moments don't get the spotlight, and very often we go right by them. And that's why, like traveling in a car, you zoom by at 60 miles an hour, you may see a lot, but the amount you miss is incredible. And it's the same in life.
Yeah, very true. And don't you find that that laughter is such a universal language?
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
Even, you know, what I found, I hear terrible reports about the French all the time, mm-hmm. being aloof. But,
right.
you know, I used to speak fluent French. I do mm-hmm. not anymore. But even if you try a little,
exactly.
people really appreciate it and will go out of their way to help you.
Exactly. And I always carry juggling balls because when you're in a country where you don't speak the language, little tiny kids just can't figure out why you can't talk. You know, they don't know, like, oh, you speak another
right.
language. And what's great with juggling balls, you don't need any language skills to make people laugh.
True.
And I always tell people this, always as a traveler, always give before you take. And giving doesn't necessarily mean rupees or a gift or a pen. Giving often is time. Take the time to smile and acknowledge people's children. Take the time to ask somebody how they are and how their farmland is doing before you ask them for directions or whatever. It's amazing what that does as far as, and people always ask, why do you get these amazing photographs when you travel? Well, part of it is I always give before I take. You know, I'd always come into a village and immediately grab my camera out and start taking pictures of people, just like I wouldn't want somebody to knock on my door and have me open and start taking pictures of me.
Mm-hmm.
For me, there needs to be a relationship before you do that. And again, with a bicycle, you're right there with him right off the bat.
Right. Do you have a favorite place? Do you have a, you know, different cultures have different rituals, different habits. Is there somewhere that you just, that just really grabs your heart?
Wow. You know, it's very often, you know, the last place that, you know, I've been. I mean, we traveled in Colombia, in Venezuela on our last journey. And, you know, the mountains of Colombia, you know, I heard so much, on the internet, you can just get way too much information. And very often, you know, you get the negative stuff out there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Colombia and its sordid history. And so it's just very easily to think it's nothing but violence and horrible. And then to spend the time up in the coffee region of Colombia in that beautiful, beautiful country with some of the most delightfully friendly people who so often thanked us and bought us breakfast very often and with the words, thank you so much for taking the time to see our country, because they've spent so long with their country trashed in the media. And of course, the country's definitely had its problems, but they're very proud and beautiful people with an absolutely, I mean, the amount of fruit and vegetation and mm-hmm. bird life, whatever, that are up in those mountains up in the Andes is just incredible. But I think for me, it's often the mountains. I mean, some mm-hmm. people, the seashore, very often the ocean for bicyclists means headwinds, which that can be, I think. But I love a mountain. And maybe it's just because a mountain pass seems to be the metaphor as a cyclist, because it is so much work, but there's so much of reward on the other side. And without work, there isn't the reward.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that.
Mm. Well, we were saying during the break that you'd sent me the magazine that you write mm-hmm. for Adventure Cyclist, and I'm not a cyclist. I do trail bike occasionally, but I like the land to be flat. But I was saying, this is a great magazine, and I read mm-hmm. almost all the articles in here.
Yeah.
And I'd often thought I'd like to go to Holland because mm-hmm. it's so flat
right.
and cycle, as the Dutch do.
Right.
But according to the guy who did that, the headwinds there are really brutal, and mm-hmm. you concurred with that.
The hardest day of cycling I think I ever had in my entire life was in Saskatchewan with a headwind of about 54 miles an hour. That was just, I felt like I'd been hit
wow.
by a Mack truck. The day prior, I had a tailwind of almost that velocity, and I cycled 170 miles without feeling like I could ever touch the pedals. It
huh.
was like being the Wicked Witch to the West, you know, on the bicycle. And I felt like I'd just been carried along in a tornado. It was absolutely incredible. And maybe it is. It's that force and those problems and dealing with them on the road that make things that much sweeter. You can be on top of a mountain pass, and that happened to me in Central America. I was on top of Irazu, which is one of the highest mountain passes in Central America, and you look out over this active volcano, and I cycled up this thing, and a man got off a tour bus with all the other people there, and they said, See this? We on this bus, we are seeing Irazu. This man on this bicycle, he is experiencing Irazu.
That's the difference.
And it was. It was the you smell it, you feel it, you taste it.
Yeah.
It's life with all of your senses and travel with all of your senses, which very often in the other ways we travel, we're robbed. I love to travel by train, but when I'm on it, I always think, oh, on my bicycle, I could stop there. Oh, I got to stop there. Oh, my God. You know, and you're just zooming by. On a bicycle, you always have that opportunity to stop.
Yeah, and met some fascinating people, had some fascinating experiences. We're almost at the end of our show, unfortunately. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I would say this, as far as, especially for Americans, because we're really good at planning, but I always say this, adventure is many, many things, but it is never planned. And you can so easily plan your way out of an adventure. We always want to plan things. We want to make sure that we're having breakfast, lunch, dinner. You take your itinerary, and you're going to go from A to this to whatever. If you want to have an adventure, you have to be able to throw it out to the wind and say, we're going to head this direction this day, and we're going to see what happens. Because when you plan it, adventure happens when plans don't work out. Adventure happens when the wind changes or somebody stops and invites you to a wedding. Well, if you've got everything planned and you're supposed to be someplace, you can't take advantage. And so allow yourself, this has to allow yourself to have maybe a boring day. You know, that can happen. Mm-hmm. But you have to take that risk. And that risk, you will find adventures that you couldn't have planned in your wildest dreams.
Well, I really enjoyed talking with you. We didn't get to a fraction of the stories. If listeners want to find out about Zeb, the traveling ambassador, you'll have to read the book to find out about that. I want to thank you for being with us. Your website is willieweir.com.
Right.
It's W-I.
LLIEWEIR.
Very good. Thank you. And there's other stuff up there. Check him out, willieweir.com. And his book, Travels with Willie, Adventure Cyclist. I thank you for traveling with us this hour. Please join us next Monday. We'll be back with an all-new live show. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.
Japanese researcher Masaru Emoto explored the vibration of music on water. Since our bodies are largely water, does it follow that music can heal our bodies? Patricia Hurlby says yes. Please join us next Monday at noon on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for Music Consciousness, The Power to Heal. See conversationslive.net for guests and show details.
Views expressed on the preceding program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily